News.
Iran says uranium enrichment continues in the Natanz nuclear facility despite Sunday's terrorist act by Israel. The Yemeni army says it has launched a major retaliatory drone attack on Aramco refineries in two Saudi cities. A former British civil servant says London's policies have deepened the division among the four nations of Britain. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Beginning with our top story, Iranian security sources say that a key individual who caused the blackout of the Natanz nuclear facility has been identified. In our news review program a short while ago, we've discussed the issue with our guests. Time now for the news review section. Now, Iran has reportedly identified the person who disrupted the flow of power at the Natanz nuclear facility, causing a blackout there. Iranian media cited intelligence sources saying all necessary measures are underway to arrest the person who caused the blackout at the nuclear plant on Sunday. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has accused Israel of the incident, pledging that Iran will take revenge. Zarif was cited by media saying that Israelis think that this way they can revenge the success made in the recent talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal. However, he said that they will get their answer in more nuclear advancements. The foreign ministry has also condemned the Israeli sabotage as an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
The official said that Iran reserves all rights to respond to the attack and has started communications with international authorities in that regard. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz won't slow down Iran's nuclear program. Instead, it'll speed the country's nuclear advancement. He said that damaged IR-1 centrifuges will be replaced with more advanced ones. Also, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Ali Akbar Salehi, said that the incident has not caused any disruption to the enrichment process at Natanz. Emergency power is provided to the facility. Let's now discuss this a little bit and shed some more light on different aspects of it. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. We'll also be joined by Syed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator out of London. Well, it's good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Elijah, you have been watching this, and this is not the first time that Israel is doing such things, and we also had the Tel Aviv regime officials openly threatening to do such things, and there you go, we have this. Let's have your comments on that.
No, it is not the first time. You're absolutely right. And if we look only in the past couple of weeks, Israel bombed Syria and claimed to have bombed facilities of Iranian advisor in the country. They also caused damage to a ship in the Red Sea. And now we see one of the most serious attempts to cause radioactive consequences in the country against the cyber attack against Natanz. And all that, it is really clear that the Israelis are trying their best to drag Iran into retaliation. They desperately want Iran to respond, and drag Iran into a war. But Israel is not alone. Although we can see from the Americans that the leak of the information is starting from the American media, quoting American officials, it means that the Israelis are asking the Americans and they're getting their approval. And the Americans are also responsible because they approved these attacks. That also lead us to understand that the Americans are also benefiting from these attacks by saying to the Iranian, we can put on the table of negotiation the stopping of all the Israeli attacks if you want to include other than the nuclear deal. But this is not going to work. Israel is trying to drag Iran to a war. Iran is not responding with a war, but it has the right to retaliate whenever it is suitable for Iran in a time of place.
Exactly, and Iran has made it clear that it has the right to revenge, but it's now responding for now with further equipping the facility and going on with the operations. Now, Said Mohsen Abbas, how do you look at this? Also, and what does it have to do with this recent visit of the U.S. Secretary of Defense to Tel Aviv? They've been also meeting yesterday and today.
That's right. Netanyahu's meeting with the U.S. Defense Secretary, Austin, is the first highest level, well, he's the highest level visit of an American establishment person into that country. So that's very significant that it's timed with that. It's also significant that you've got the Vienna talks that have just tried to restart the possibility of breaking the impasse. So it's obviously part of a process in which the Americans and the Israelis are trying to destabilize any chances of Iranian sanctions, etc., really being lifted, the American sanctions on Iran, for instance. But as far as the actual incident goes regarding the Natanz, well, we know that in July 2010, there was a fire that, sorry, it was July 2020, the fire actually broke out in Natanz. So it's not the first time that they've attacked Natanz. They've also had the Stuxnet, which I was going to mention, for 2010, the Stuxnet's cyber warfare attack, which was one of the first public kind of, if you like, revelations of this kind of warfare. So, yeah, I mean, they're using every trick in the book at the moment, the Israelis, to try and destabilize Iran, to try and cow it into submission.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, joined us from Brussels. And Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, out of London with their comments and insights. Let's now move on. The Yemeni army saying it has performed fresh drone strikes, successfully hitting targets in southern Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Saria says that the armed forces carried out drone and ballistic missile attacks targeting Aramco's refineries in the areas of Jeddah and Jebel. He said that the army also targeted sensitive military sites in Hamas Mushayt and Jazan using drones and battered ballistic missiles. The attacks were in response to the Saudi air raids and the regime's blockade on the country. The general added that the attacks will continue as long as Riyadh goes on with its deadly military campaign against Yemen.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jazan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country, and we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant their demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, speaking of Yemen, going without food for even a day can be hard for some, but in Yemen, millions have been struggling with hunger for months. The Saudi-tight blockade on the war-ravaged nation has left many people fighting for their lives. Their voices are now being heard abroad, like in the U.S., where some hunger strikers are calling for an end to the devastating war.
A group of activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
Well, what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis?
Several UN agencies have warned that some 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could succumb to starvation this year. According to a World Food Program estimate, 2.3 million Yemeni children in the same age group are facing severe malnutrition. Also, 50,000 Yemenis are facing famine-like conditions, with 5 million others just a step away from this worst-case scenario.
During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment We are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. Although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as the U.S. Vice President in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapon sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia's soon to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
Moving on, a former British civil servant is warning that Prime Minister Johnson's, quote, muscular brand of unionism has deepened the division among the four nations of Britain. Philip Ryecroft says London's imperialist disregard for development policies have fueled support for the Scottish independence and the Irish reunification. He says that the COVID pandemic has also ignited the notion that a prime minister speaks for England alone. He noted that there is widespread ignorance toward the union. Ryecroft says that means the ministers can be kept uninformed of major reforms with little consideration for the four nations. England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland form the UK, but calls are growing louder in Scotland and Wales for separation. Tension is also on the rise in Northern Ireland over trade following Britain's departure from the European Union. The U.S. police have clashed with protesters who'd gathered in Minneapolis to condemn the police killing of yet another African-American. They used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators gathered outside the police headquarters holding Black Lives Matter banners and signs calling for justice. They also blocked the road despite heavy security presence. 20-year-old Donta Wright was killed after officers attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation on Sunday. He tried to get back into his car when the deadly encounter happened. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has launched an investigation. The governor of Virginia has promised a thorough probe into an incident where two police officers assaulted a black Army lieutenant. Ralph Norum called the incident disturbing, promising an independent investigation. That's after Lieutenant Kara Nazario filed charges against the officers. They said they pointed their guns and threatened to murder him. Nazario, of a Latino and black ethnicity, had his hands up and showed no resistance, but it was pepper sprayed and violently knocked to the ground before being arrested. The incident was captured on police body cameras and on Nazario's cell phone. The federal court is investigating the case at a time of heightened awareness over police brutality and racial injustice. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The enemy's endeavor to discourage the people from participating in elections.
Let me add that. This is based on the information available to us. The espionage and the intelligence services of certain countries, the worst ones being the US and the Zionist regime, have been trying since a while ago, not today, to undermine the upcoming elections in Khordad. They either accuse the organizers, saying that the elections have been engineered. In fact, they level their accusation against the organizers of the elections or the Honorable Guardian Council, or they discourage the people by saying, your votes are of no consequence in improving the circumstances. So why would you tire yourselves participating in the elections? They're adopting these courses of action with complete intensity.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to me. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Enemy is making the most of cyberspace.
And they are making the most of cyberspace. Well, the necessary regulations are unfortunately not observed in cyberspace, despite all my emphasis. In certain aspects, cyberspace is completely free of any supervision. Those who are in charge should be careful. All countries in the world are controlling their cyberspace, but we are proud of letting it roam freely. There is no reason to be proud of this in any way. Cyberspace should be managed. The people should be able to use it freely, and this is completely all right, but this instrument should not be put at the disposal of the enemy so that he will conspire against the country and the nation. They are taking advantage of cyberspace, and their goal is to reduce the people's participation in the elections with psychological methods. I hope that the people will reject and disappoint the enemy, and they will not forget about this important issue. This is the first issue which was about the significance of elections.
The significance of the presidency as the heaviest managerial responsibility of the country.
The second issue is about the significance of the presidency. The presidency is a very important issue. The most important and influential managerial responsibility is the presidency. Now, some people claim that the president has no authority, that he is a mere caterer, and that he has just 12-15% authority. I do not know how they calculate these things. It is several years now that they have been saying these things here and there, but all of them are untrue.
Thank you.
Research Monitoring Group on Global Arms Sales has confirmed that the United States maintains its status as the world's biggest exporter of weapons, a title that Washington has held since the end of the Cold War. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, also referred to as SIPRI, found that between 2016 and 2020, around 47% of all U.S. arms exports went to American allies in the Middle East. That's a rise of 28% compared to the previous 5 years. In a report, it found that U.S. exports to North Africa had also witnessed a spike. Generally, global arms sales stabilized with the exception of the Middle East and North Africa. The research suggests these two destinations are lucrative markets for Western arms suppliers, despite the wars, the death, and the destruction in the two regions. Analysts are left asking how Washington can talk of peace in Yemen, for example, while it is complicit in the killing of civilians there. Saudi Arabia made up 11% of the total arms import market worldwide and is the biggest importer of US, UK, and Canadian arms. In February, US President Joe Biden had claimed that Washington would end the relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used in the kingdom's war on Yemen, which he referred to as offensive weapons. But arms controls advocates are not exactly celebrating. They are calling for more transparency. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says it's not quite clear yet where the administration will land on what weapons they deem to be offensive. The Washington-based NGO also says, "We've seen other sales that indicate the Biden administration may be staying the course on less high-profile but still very concerning arms sales." Just recently, the Biden administration had been condemned for approving a $197 million arms sale to Egypt, despite human rights concerns there. The SIPRI report also reveals that not only was the U.S. the largest exporter of weapons, but over the last 5 years, its global share of arms exports had increased from 32 to 37%. In contrast, Russian arms exports decreased by 22% during the same period. This has increased the gap between the two of the world's largest exporters of arms. The report also notes that the U.S. had supplied major arms to 96 countries, far more than any other nation. Saudi Arabia alone accounted for 24% of all U.S. arms sales. Analysts say conflicts such as the Saudi war on Yemen can quite easily come to an end if Washington halts its large arms exports. Critics also argue that by sending arms to conflict zones, the U.S. has put profits for its arms manufacturing companies over the lives of innocent civilians. Project South has described SIPRI's findings as deplorable. The advocacy group says the U.S. government specifically is willing to close its eyes on the atrocities committed by governments if they are reliable importers of U.S.-made war-making machines. It added that, instead of supporting peace, the global north continues the colonial tradition of war making. This also explains the lack of concrete action on the systematic human rights abuses of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Rights groups have heavily criticized America's long-standing warm ties with dictatorships in West Asia. They argue that despite these regimes waging war on other countries and despite their terrible rights record, the lucrative arms trade appears to come first for Washington. Peace advocates also argue that as the arms exports allow conflicts to drag on and on, American arms manufacturers count their ever-expanding profits over an ever-expanding list of dead women and children.
The government in Baghdad is under pressure from the parliament and many political groups to force out the remaining U.S. troops in Iraq.
Calls for the withdrawal of all American troops have been growing louder amid rising anti-U.S. sentiments across Iraq. There have been popular demonstrations against the presence of foreign troops on Iraqi soil. Meanwhile, U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq have come under a growing number of attacks over the past months. It's been proving more difficult to protect foreign troops who have defied the calls to leave. This week, Baghdad and Washington agreed on the withdrawal of all remaining U.S. and coalition combat troops from Iraq. The two sides issued a statement saying that the agreement was reached following their first strategic dialogue under U.S. President Joe Biden. But this week's agreement does not mean that the mission of U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq is over. They will still provide training and assistance to Iraqi armed forces. The Iraqi army says it will set up a committee that would hold technical talks with the U.S. to draw up mechanisms and timings related to the redeployment. How will political parties and resistance groups react to this week's announcement? Critics have questioned the agreement, arguing that Baghdad could find it difficult to sell the new arrangement to the Iraqi people and political groups.
I think the U.S. has no intention to really leave Iraq or the region. I think they will make one pretense after another, one negotiation after another, one renaming of the troops that they have in country, but I don't think they plan to leave.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. The anti-Americanism was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attacks on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces. But America is still refusing to heed that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safer, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, the U.S. withdrew several hundreds of its forces from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite repeated pledges to end American military presence in the region. The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from former U.S. President Donald Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region.
Last year, nearly 66 million Brazilians received money from the government's largest ever financial aid program. Almost $60 billion was provided for the most vulnerable to help them survive the coronavirus crisis. However, the aid program expired in 2020 and dragged millions of Brazilians into poverty in the first quarter of the year. Researchers estimate that some 27 million people are now living below the poverty line. That is 12.8% of Brazil's population. Brazil recorded its deadliest 24 hours of the pandemic on Tuesday, with over 4,000 COVID-19 fatalities. That marked the highest number of daily deaths to the virus globally since the beginning of the pandemic. Authorities in Sao Paulo say the plan to open a vertical cemetery to handle continuing surge in coronavirus deaths. Brazil has so far reached a grim milestone of 337,000 virus deaths. That is second only to the U.S. the South American country, has also recorded over 13 million cases. The record daily count comes as hospitals and intensive care units in some cities are turning patients away, and as the nation's entire health system is on the brink of collapse. The World Health Organization has described the situation in Brazil as very serious, saying a number of its states are in critical condition. The WHO says hospitals are overwhelmed nationwide, and over 90% of ICU beds are full. In its annual report, NGO Amnesty International denounced the escalation of poverty and police violence in Brazil during the pandemic. The report said that at least 3,100 people were killed by police across the country between January and June. It also wrapped President Jair Bolsonaro's measures during the crisis.
A lot of this blame can be attributed to Bolsonaro. There's many issues when it comes to how he handled the pandemic and how that reflected back onto the Brazilian economy. He's a staunch advocate of austerity measures and cutting the national budget. And in the middle of a pandemic, when you need to put more money into the economy, put more money into the society, and actually funding programs for the people and giving money to the people so that they can sustain themselves, Bolsonaro did the opposite.
While the coronavirus pandemic keeps battering the world's second worst nation, a political earthquake has worsened the situation even further. Last month, the Brazilian president was forced to replace several ministers in the biggest cabinet reshuffle since he took power in January 2019. Bolsonaro fired Brazil's defense minister, Fernando Azevedo de Silva, and subsequently the heads of Army, Navy, and Air Force resigned. Some Brazilian media said the heads of the three branches of the armed forces had resigned in protest at the president's decision to replace Azevedo. On Wednesday, opposition lawmakers from the Brazilian Chamber of Deputies and the Federal Senate filed a new impeachment motion against Bolsonaro. They slammed the president, calling him a threat to democracy. They also accused Bolsonaro of attempting to arrange a coup.
Lula had said similar things, that the biggest threat to the world right now is his first name is Jair and his last name is Bolsonaro. And I think this is very true, not only in the case of, you know, ruining the Brazilian economy and endangering the lives of Brazilians, but also in terms of endangering the lives of people throughout the world by allowing the virus to spread, which, you know, leads to multiple different forms and variants of the virus, which will eventually spread throughout Latin America.
The departure of top military chiefs might suggest resistance to a military coup. However, it gives Bolsonaro the chance to fill military positions with friendlier figures who could help to protect him from impeachment or assess him in his bid to win re-election next year.
A new report suggests there was a 33% rise in crimes in major U.S. cities last year amid then prevailing anger over racial injustice and police brutality across the country. The report released by the Major Cities Chiefs Association includes murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. It says 63 of the 66 largest police jurisdictions saw increases in at least one category of violent crimes. This as the surge in homicide rates in the U.S. is both historic and far-reaching. The report suggests that a crime surge has continued into the first quarter of 2021. In Chicago, murders are up 33% in the first 3 months of the year compared to 2020, while shootings are up nearly 40% for the same period. In New York City, the NYPD figures show murders has jumped by nearly 14% through March 28, while shootings were up nearly 50%. In Los Angeles, homicides have increased nearly 36% from 67 to 91 through March 30th. Those three cities also saw a significant increase in 2019, too. The increase in homicide rate in the three cities come as Chicago, Houston, and Memphis last year saw an increase of 100 or more killings compared to 2019.
With all of the marches and the protests, some of the word that I was hearing from the street, from people that I know that were out there in the street, the elements, they were telling me that a lot of law enforcement was in certain places, they were just saying, work slow down. They weren't gonna be as pushing to go after criminals as you know, from the way they were in the past, because they felt like a lot of them were being thrown under the bus. So I believe that you might, with the, if the criminal element knows that and understands that, then a lot of times they will use that opportunity to do the their nefarious acts and to go after people to get revenge, everything else, because they feel like they're hearing that there's a police slowdown, work slowdown. So I think all of that, when you add all of that into it, and then you add the economic situation of the pandemic, the fact that people don't have access to the, you know, the resources, money, and the things they did have, it just opened up a can of worms.
Chicago alone saw 18 homicides in a single day, this largest number of murders on record. The surge in crimes and killings are blamed on a number of factors, ranging from economic collapse to social anxiety caused by COVID-19 to depolicing in major cities to the release of criminal defendants pre-trial or before sentences are completed to reduce risk of COVID-19 spread in jails. COVID-19 seemed to further exacerbate things. Officers sometimes had to quarantine because of exposure or cases in their ranks. That especially came into light following the killing of African-American George Floyd at the hands of white U.S. police officers, which set up the largest protest movements in American history in late May last year. It's nearly impossible to attribute any year-to-year change in violent crimes statistics to any single factor. However, many believe the COVID-19 pandemic, the subsequent economic hardships, and anti-racism protests are to blame for the spike in the number of crimes. But the question is why the U.S. has such a high crime rate.
Well, again, in the United States, is more than any other nation in the world, has more guns on the street than any place else. So our gun laws have made it easy for people to obtain weapons. And, of course, a lot of these crimes are committed with guns. So when we look at the extraordinary amount of guns that are on the street, as I said before, the cat's already out the bag. And then the fact that people have the means to do criminal activity. And then if you have a police slowdown, work slowdown, because law enforcement is upset because they feel like they're being thrown under the bus. They're not being thrown under the bus, but if they feel that way, then you have a work slowdown. If that gets to the street and the criminal element hears that law enforcement is not going to be investigating them the way they normally do, then you're going to have an uptake in crime, in violent crime. That's going to automatically happen.
What's Trump to be blamed?
Crime is out there, and you can't really stop it, which that's been the problem. I don't know if you can blame the Trump administration, other than the fact that the rhetoric on law enforcement, instead of them addressing the issue of police brutality and police misconduct, the rhetoric was like, well, you know, don't do anything wrong. And that wasn't the right rhetoric, because the bottom line is people felt like a lot of groups were emboldened to do things that normally they would not have done before. So in that sense, maybe the administration had some culpability.
There are some other factors conducive to the dire situation in the U.S. Some say America's list of woes appears to be too long. The economy is on the decline, wages are low, economic growth is down, the U.S. companies are not competitive in global markets, and the gap between the haves and have-nots is going deeper and deeper. All these problems, compounded by the highest surge in crime rates, have made many thinkers and observers in the U.S. obsessed with decline, and the concept has ushered the new school of thought, declinism.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
So Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. In this episode, we're going to be talking about something that we've spoken about before, and that is the topic of sleeping. But in this chapter, chapter 11, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli dedicates this whole chapter about having a healthy Islamic sleeping pattern and also utilizing and benefiting from the day that you have. Imam Al-Kadhim Salamullahi Alayhi, he says, La'ana Rasulullah Sallallahu Alayhi Wa Alihi Thalatha, that Rasulullah cursed three types of people. And this is to do with sleeping alone, sleeping by yourself. You should not sleep alone. You should try to avoid sleeping alone in normal circumstances. Make sure that there is someone with you, at least in the same house. Doesn't necessarily need to be in the same room, but at least in the same house. One of the cursed is al-na'ima fi baytin wahdahu, someone who is sleeping in a house all alone. Of course, intentionally wanting to be as such. As for when to sleep, there are places or times when it is good for a person to sleep. For example, it's recommended to have that qaylula sleep, which is just before noontime, just a little power nap, if we could say. Maghrib time is very, very bad for a person to sleep. Between Maghrib and Isha is a very bad time for a person to sleep. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, Al-nawmu bayna al-isha'ayn yurithu al-faqr. Sleeping between Maghrib and Isha brings about poverty. Sleeping after Fajr and before sunrise is also a bad time. It's very recommended, very mustahab to stay awake during this particular time. والنوم قبل طلوع الشمس يورث الفقر. If you were to sleep before sunrise, that also brings about poverty. Remembering that too much sleeping is always bad. Make sure that you have that custom in your life that you always are an early bird. You always wake up early in the morning. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, كَثْرَةُ النَّوْمِ مَذْهَبَةٌ لِلدِّينِ وَالدُّنْيَا. Too much sleeping will ruin your deen and also your dunya. A person who's always waking up late, how are they going to gain sustenance? How are they going to generate an income? How are they going to prove that they are effective and successful and have ambitions and have seek opportunities in their life? And that's why it's always very, very important. I'd like to share this hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Very interesting hadith. أَرْبَعَةٌ الْقَلِيلُ مِنْهَا كَثِيرٌ. That even its minimum is way too much. النَّارُ الْقَلِيلُ مِنْهَا كَثِيرٌ. That small amount of fire is still too much. وَالْنَوْمَ الْقَلِيلُ مِنْهُ كَثِيرٌ. A small amount of sleeping is still too much. وَالْمَرَضُ الْقَلِيلُ مِنْهُ كَثِيرٌ. And a small amount of sickness is still too much. وَالْعَدَاوَةُ الْقَلِيلُ مِنْهَا كَثِيرٌ. And having an enemy, as minimum as the number might be of enemies, it is still too much. So we need to remember that, you know, the least amount is always going to be the best, because it is going to allow us to benefit from something even more. We should utilize the time and benefit from the opportunities that are ahead of us, because indeed we're going to be responsible and accountable in the eyes of Almighty God.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The hadith says from Imam Ali alayhi salam, Al-fursatu, opportunities, Al-fursatu tamurru marra sihab, opportunities pass as fast as clouds do. Fantahizu furas al-khayr, so seize good opportunities. Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Ida'atul fursa ghussa, for you to lose an opportunity is grief. It's going to be grievous, and it's going to be a source of sorrow as well. So we need to always remember that there are many things that we are able to do in benefiting from the whole day that we have. And remembering that everything comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Always remembering that we should avoid having that level of pride or ego, or even being too over confident. Iyyaka wal i'jabu bi nafsik wa thiqatu bima yu'jibuka minha. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, be careful, don't think too much of yourself. You know, don't have too much confidence. Don't be too proud. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Dhikrullahi ala kulli hal," remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in every opportunity that you have, does not mean that you just say laysa. Does not mean that you just say subhanallahi walhamdulillahi wa la ilaha illallah wallahu akbar. That's not what dhikrullah in any situation means. Walakin idha warada alayka shay'. However, what does dhikrullah mean? Remembering God. You know, we're talking about when you're awake, when you're not sleeping, remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, benefit from the time that you have. He says, إِذَا وَرَدَ عَلَيْكَ شَيْءٌ أَمَرَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ بِهِ أَخَذْتَ بِهِ. Remembering God means that if something passes you, or if something is ahead of you, or if you are faced with something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded you to do, you act upon it. وَإِذَا وَرَدَ عَلَيْكَ شَيْءٌ نَهَى اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ عَنْهُ تَرَكْتَهُ. And if there is something that you face that God has prohibited you from acting upon and doing, you abandon it and you don't do it. That's what ذكرullah عز وجل means. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف خلق الله محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahlaib. In this week's episode, we will look at the Syrian war, or the war on Syria, should I say, which turned 10, a milestone to be ashamed of. I mean, what can be said about the Syrian war that has not been said already? Well, that is exactly the point. It needs to remain in the headlines. Now, before the war on Syria broke out, Syria had two main products for revenues, namely agriculture and oil. Together, they accounted for about one half of the country's GDP. Agriculture, for instance, accounted for about 26% of the GDP and employed 25% of the total labor force. Well, the sanctions and destruction have devastated Syria's economy. For example, the total economic loss from the Syrian civil war for the year 2015 was $237 billion. Now, it could have reached $400 billion for the year 2020, as far as the records go. Well, the Syrian opposition's capture cost the government a further $507 million a year because of the revenue loss at the border crossing, Nasib being the biggest one. In this program, we will not only try to cover the economic consequences of this war, but we will also give a touch of the humanitarian aspect, which is truly heartbreaking. Well, the first report will take a look at the timeline of this war, which has just marked its 10-year anniversary.